Hi, I'm Brad Diedrich. Welcome to this podcast. This is actually a segment for Art House, an RBM program on Thursday nights, and this is the BM Cairns segment. BM Cairns stands for Blue Mounds Creative Arts Network. I'm here with Anne Blair Hickman and her guest, Peter Long. Peter Long is a local Blue Mountains musician who is currently finishing off a PhD. He also plays in a number of bands in the Blue Mountains, the Winstons, Paper Sun, and he also has been involved with BM Cairns in a lot of different projects. He's been on boards, he's been on the Carla committee. Anyway, I'm going to introduce Anne and Peter. Hello, Anne.
Good morning, Brad.
And hello, Peter.
Good morning, Brad.
Now, you'll have to clear up the BM Cairns because I was just winging it there, but you were involved on a committee, on a...
With the awards committee for
For Carla.
Yeah.
So, and also you'll hear this this interview as a podcast for Talking Arts. Talking Arts are podcasts with artists talking to artists, and we've been doing interviews recently rather than the live events because of the current pandemic. So you'll be able to hear this interview as the next one of those after the last one we did with Wendy Chai, with Craig Billingham and Judith Estrada. I'll hand over to you now, Anne, so you can talk to Peter.
Thanks, Brad. Well, it's an absolute pleasure to meet you today, Peter.
Likewise, thank you.
Yes, I feel like I've been living under a rock after that wonderful introduction that Brad just gave. And yeah, this is the first time that I've got to meet you and to hear a bit of your story. So yeah, really looking forward to, you know, getting to know you a little bit better.
Sure.
Well, I don't know you at all, but it's, you know, so there's going to be a bit of a journey of discovery here. But many people in the mountains do already know you, and they're very familiar with your music and with your, you know, varied and many accomplishments. So let's chat.
Okay, sounds good.
Alrighty, so let's start with you're a mountains man.
Yes, been living in the mountains for the last 17 years with my partner Louise and my son Griffin, who's now 15.
Great, and what came before the mountains?
I grew up in Adelaide, way over yonder. What can I tell you about Adelaide? Adelaide's a lovely town, but it's quiet. There's usually not a great deal happening. When I was growing up, and we're talking about sort of the 60s going into the 70s, there was a great sense of progression.
Yeah.
Don Dunstan was in government. The Festival Arts Centre was being built. So it was very, it felt very progressive, and the arts were being encouraged. And of course, when Whitlam came in the 70s, everyone just went, hooray, the arts have their day. And there was a lot of initiatives started around that time. So it was quite exciting. That's my memory of Adelaide growing up at that time. And I guess as a kid, and what I was into, I loved music, I loved art, I loved drawing. I was a creative kid. I was fairly, I won't say isolated, but I was quiet, and I lived very much in my own imagination. I was always inventing scenarios and worlds and things in my head. So I was an insular sort of kid.
Were you an only child?
No, I've got a younger sister as well.
Okay.
Yeah. But we would very much occupy ourselves, and it was a rural upbringing in an area called Happy Valley.
Beautiful.
South of Adelaide, so southern winery belt near McLaren Vale, near Ranella. So paddocks, sheep, chickens, surrounded by grapevines all up and down. So this is in the foothills of Adelaide.
Yeah,
so it's quite idyllic. It was really lovely.
I always think of those sort of surreal, you know, sort of American TV shows where they, you know, it's a play on the sort of idyllic town. It's always called Pleasant Valley or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's always very Stepford Wivey.
There'd always be some sinister plot going on in the background. No, that's just Adelaide.
That's it. It just doesn't seem like anyone, you know, would ever want to leave Happy Valley, but you did.
I did.
And where did you head to after that?
From Adelaide, I spent a great deal of time there. I was involved in bands there, and we tried to make our success as well as we could. But there's always been a sense of Adelaide being a kind of a step below, behind Brisbane or Melbourne or Sydney, I think. So there was a yearning by the time I'd sort of hit my late 20s, I needed to get out. And I had other friends who had moved interstate by that point. And the music scene that I was in at the time, and if we're talking late 90s, the advent of dance music was coming in. We also had the Pokies coming in various capital cities around Australia. Mm. So the live music scene was, it was being, it was coming down in its sort of importance, I guess. And I had a sense I needed to get out while I could, because I didn't see anything good happening in the Adelaide music scene at the time.
Yeah.
So who were the bands playing at that time?
The bands I was in, or
no, the popular bands. Who were the Adelaide bands at that?
Adelaide bands. So we're talking about the Greasy Pop label.
Yeah.
Doug Thomas started Greasy Pop. We're talking his bands initially, like the Dagos, but you might remember Exploding White Mice.
Yep, yep.
I'm just trying to think. The Spikes. I was in a band called Primitive Painters. There was also the Mad Turks.
Oh, yes.
From Charles Jenkins came from that band. He went on to form Ice Cream Hands and various other. So
great band, Ice Cream Hands.
Mm, yeah, fantastic pop stuff. So there was this fantastic mix of punky, grungy stuff and some very astute pop writers as well.
Yeah.
So Primitive Painters, the band I was in, was signed to the Greasy Pop label, and we were the pop side of Greasy Pop.
Right.
And bands like Lizard Train and Exploding White Mice were the greasy side of the label. So there was this lovely dualism.
You're going to have to dig out some music for me now.
Yeah. I'll see what I can find.
From that band. Would you still have something?
Yes, I've got a few bits and pieces.
So you did release?
Yeah, we had one release called Sea of Art.
Right.
That came out in 1990.
Okay.
And we did a bit of touring. We went to Melbourne a couple of times in Sydney, which was fun. But again, I guess independent labels releasing through majors, because we went through Festival didn't give us probably the support that we needed at the time. And it just kind of fell in a heap. We did all the initial promotion, but there was no follow-up.
Sure. Yeah.
So how old were you when you started your first band, or when you entered your first band?
When I did my first band, I was probably about 16 or 17.
Okay.
Again, played in cover bands for a while.
Yep.
I became the Primitive Painters through my sister, because my sister was going out with the lead singer and songwriter at the time.
That's so how it always works.
Yeah.
It's always it's never they went, oh, what a great guitarist, I'll stay there. No, it's, oh, you're going out with my sister, can I join the band?
Yeah, almost. It took a little while. And as it happened, she wasn't his girlfriend for very long, but we, I sort of hung around enough, and because of what I do, I'm a graphic designer and photographer as well. I was taking photographs, I was doing flyers and posters, I would do demo recordings as well for the band, and just by, I think, association of being that handy guy that was always doing stuff, hey, do you want to join the band? Oh, you play guitar too. Oh, yeah, actually, Pete would be really good. So after about 2 years of
welcome
just
to my
drifting,
world. That's exactly what I do. Yeah.
You're the handy guy that everyone knows. So, I kind of fell into it like that. And that was late 80s, and as I said, we released that album in 90. Didn't do much, and the band had pretty much imploded by 91.
So I have to ask, did you have fans?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And like, lady fans throwing themselves at you and, you know, sort of...
No, I don't think we were that sort of band, I don't think it was that sort of time either.
Okay.
You know, we weren't a haircut band.
Be lots of... yeah. Probably be more like lots of nerdy guys who come to every gig and... after about the fifth gig, get the courage up to come up and say hello.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it was a bit more cerebral. It was pop.
Yeah.
Even if you look at the photographs of the time, we weren't that.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have that sort of appeal. So it's a different sort of thing.
Yeah.
Certainly not a boy band.
Yeah.
We were a cool indie band.
Yeah.
Inner city Adelaide, which was great. And at the time, you know, it was great to be able to walk down the main street and someone would just come up to you that you didn't know and go, hey, I saw you on a weekend. That was great.
Yeah.
What a fantastic song. And I go, thanks, man.
You know. Good job.
So it was a good time. It was a good time.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And so after Adelaide, where did we head?
After Adelaide, I think after that, with that initial foray of, well, smell of success, if you like, I did some other bands for a little while. I was in a band called the Oily Penguins, but ostensibly that was pretty much a cover band. We did some original stuff. And that had run its course, and the singer from that band had left and gone to Sydney. That was Pat Lockery. And I was kind of drifting. I didn't know quite what to do at that point. So I thought maybe it's time to get out of here. So late 90s, where are we talking? 96, I moved to Melbourne for a while. Tried to make inroads into that scene. That didn't really come to anything. And I was in a relationship at that time which was just failing badly. So I was almost looking for excuses to actually get out of town.
Yeah.
I did some guesting with a guy called Matt Dalton. He had a band called The Bright Electric in Melbourne, and that was good, but again, nothing was really coming of it. So Pat, who had gone ahead to Sydney, had got into, of all things, an Oasis tribute band. That was called Noasis, because Oasis had failed to show for tours on about three occasions, I think. They'd book a tour, then they'd cancel, then they'd book the tour again, and they would cancel. So this was supposed to be the Sydney answer to Oasis. And he said, I'm going to be Liam, and you're going to be Noel, mate. So come up. And I went, yeah, why not? So I moved up to Sydney and did that for a while. And we just did all these insane tribute shows because, of course, in...
Did you put on an attitude while you were at the gigs?
Completely. We did the whole thing. We did the whole dress-up and wigs and, you know, sunglasses and the whole thing. Yeah.
But it'd be that air of disdain that you'd have to carry to pull off...
It just looks like it's something that you really enjoyed. Your whole body language, you know, just became quite animated as you were talking about that. So
it's the one and only time I've ever done a tribute band ever, and it was, I don't think I would ever do it again, but it was quite an experience to adopt this persona and pretend you were someone else for a while.
Yes.
Behave outrageously badly on stage.
And have an excuse.
And swear and carry on. Mm-hmm. And people would love it. We did a gig at Bondi Junction at an Irish bar, and this was on the just after Princess Diana had been killed in that car accident. So there was a lot of drunk English people there, and they were just looking for an excuse to party. So we did an Oasis show there, and they were smashing glasses, and by the time we finished, it was like a sea of glass all over the floor. It was incredible.
Wow.
So, you know, through this band that wasn't really a band, we could whip up this incredible fervour, which was gratifying, but it felt a bit very shallow too, obviously, because you're pretending to be someone else. So,
well, it's more of a show. It's more of a...
Yes.
You know, it's more musical theatre than rock and roll. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Great fun, though.
And so what was the tie then? What pulled you to the Blue Mountains after that?
After that, I'd been in Sydney for a while. Again, tried to get a few original bands going. We had a... Myself and Pat on the side did another band called Resounder, and we had Amar Zaid from Rat Cat, the bass player from Rat Cat. And that did okay in the Sydney scene. Didn't really come to anything. I formed another band called Boom Boom, which was strange indie pop, very quirky sort of stuff, with bass player Joe Herbert. And that was good, but it wasn't really getting everywhere. It just felt I was stuck at a particular level. And about that time, I had struck up a relationship with someone up here in the Blue Mountains. So I was doing my indie stuff down in Sydney, then coming up on the weekends and staying and going back down again. And gradually over that time, and becoming more and more disenfranchised with the very close-knit indie scene, which can be very... backstabby and can get quite nasty, and I was getting really over this. I've been doing this now for 20 years.
What years was this in?
We're talking early 2000s.
Right, okay.
Yeah, sort of say 2003 to 2003.
Okay.
And we weren't encouraged by the situation with the Pokies, and dance music was definitely on the increase, and I was working in Street Press at the time. I worked at Revolver magazine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
cool.
I was there for about 3 years.
I went there a couple of times.
Yeah.
Did a couple of things.
I probably saw you.
You probably did.
Yeah.
And ignored me totally. I was an annoying little punk drummer who would come in and hassle them about, doing articles on punkies and things like that.
Right.
But I'd been playing in punk bands like Out West, out of Parramatta and such. But we'd come in and play the Civic every now and again.
Yeah.
And I also knew some people at the ABC and at Triple J and Richard Kingsmill and people like that. And so we'd come in. But you go around the magazines just to say, oh, can we get an article? And there was a guy who was like the punk journalist, used to write in on the street and drum and all those sort of things.
Okay.
And he would occasionally get an article in Revolver, I think. Like Brian? Bruce? Bruce?
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
Wasn't Bruce Helder for...
No, 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 no. But, yeah, no. He wrote whenever there was, like, articles about, you know, sort of B-grade punk bands, you know, like Anti-Hierarchy and World War 24 and that sort of level before you get up to the, you know, the New Races and all those. Mm. He would write the article and so we'd all pile along and give our 2 cents worth and blah, blah, blah. But Revolver was a great magazine.
It was great. It sort of had an irreverence to it. I think that drum media took itself quite seriously, I think, at that point in time. And Revolver just didn't care, you know. We were just going to have a whole lot of fun while we're doing it.
And yeah, yeah.
Yep. And let's see how it goes until the whole thing blows up in our faces. So
Yeah. There was one guy that used to work at Tag, and my wife used to work at Tag. You know that little Tag magazine, the little booklet one? Did you ever see that?
No.
Yeah, he was one of the founders of that, and then he was working at Revolver, I think.
Okay.
Can't remember his name, sorry.
Yeah. Journo?
Yeah.
Craig?
Yes.
Yeah.
He worked at Tag.
Yeah, he was great.
Yeah, he was. He was very good.
Yeah,
cool.
Young okay, guy. So I'm going to bring you back on your on your journey. little sidestep there.
No, back but to anyway,
that's it. Come back to me. all right. So now we're in the Blue Mountains.
Now we're in the Blue Mountains.
Yeah. And look, in preparation for the interview, I did a little bit of stalking, just to find out a little bit more about you and what you've been working on recently.
Sure.
And I have to say, you know, the one thing that grabbed me. It came out of your states of suspension.
Mm.
So I'm just going to read something here for you.
Okay.
You'll recognise it.
Oh, God.
Okay. So it says, have you ever been so lost in music that it took you to another place in your mind, a place where time and space stood still, a place where dreams began and imagination took hold?
Mm.
Beautiful.
Oh, good.
Thank you. So I would love you to talk about the states of suspension, what that's about, the inspiration. Tell me what's inspirational. What is it in you that took you into this journey to go into your PhD? Your PhD and to explore this area. The states of suspension.
I'll try and unpack it. It's I'll take a running jump and lead up to it gradually.
Okay.
Else it won't make any sense.
Okay, great.
I guess going back to what we were saying before, as a kid, being very in my imagination and being very in that place, I was just always interested in music especially, but also visuals to some extent, that could put you in a state of mind where it was conducive to dream states or where you were going into...
Mm.
Highly imaginative states, and by the time I'd got up to the mountains and started my bachelor degree at Western Sydney University, I was wondering what it was, what was this trigger all the time that was that in music in particular, but it was also visuals that would put you in those sort of places. So I was trying to discover this and take it apart. So in my honours research, I looked at music in particular. I left the visual side of it alone. But I've always had an interest in music in conjunction with visuals. They've gone hand in hand. So at the same time that I've been a music artist, if you like, I've been a graphic designer and photographer. And those things have always worked hand in hand for me. And I've always been interested in these states that you can get into in music where you feel like you're literally in another world. If that kind of music is transporting enough and puts you in the right environment, you are totally lost in your imagination. So after a while, and with the encouragement of my supervisors, they sort of said, well, what is it exactly that is doing this? What do you think it might be? So the PhD research is really about trying to find out the particular factors in music that contribute to those sort of headspaces. The PhD takes it a little bit further because it takes visual side of this into account and tries to discover what are the actual factors visually that contribute to this experience and why there is actually a crossover. There's a sort of cross-modal aspect to it between the visual and the auditory that contributes to the experience.
How fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, you know, just from my own personal experience and listening to the music that was played at the event back in 2018, and where that transported me. And that's without knowing kind of, you know, the background to all of this music. And for me, the first thing that rose for me, it wasn't a thought, it was a feeling. So, and that feeling was the same feeling I get when I go down to my sweet spot. It's a rock called Peace Rock, where I just look out over the mountains and I let the world and all the mind chatter and everything go, and I just sit and I'm just one with the world.
Yeah.
And so that's a place it took me to. So interesting to hear that, you know, that pretty much is, you know, explains.
And are you breaking it down scientifically? Are you sort of saying that Anne's sitting on a rock having certain endorphins happen? And
not to that point, because you've got to, if you're going to do a PhD, you have to draw on the experience that you have.
Right.
And I'm not a psychoanalyst, I'm not a biochemist, I can't do all that sort of stuff. So I have to do it from an artistic aesthetic perspective.
Right.
But I drew on little bits of psychoanalytical mumbo jumbo, if you like. And ultimately it's expressed, because this is a practice-based PhD, I can use my artistic practice to back this up.
Of course.
Which doesn't mean it's just a lot of waffle and, you know, you hope, cross your fingers at the end and go, I've made an artistic statement. But you do have to back it up with some theory. Okay. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, to what percentage would you assign the work you're doing, such as Suspension? Are you there as an artist purely, and then you do the PhD work retrospectively, or are you there actually pressing effects going, I wonder how this is going to make those people feel, and I can write about later on?
Both. It's going through your artistic practice and how you approach it.
Yeah.
You're looking at the... and it is literally doing, I'm going to make such a sound. What sort of mental state does this put me in? If I do this thing and do a loop and make it go round and round and round, is it that putting me into a trance state? You know, those sort of things.
Yeah.
So there are multiple aspects to it. You're looking at audience response, which is the performative side of States of Suspension.
Yep.
But there's also your own practice and how it makes you feel. So there's a comparison. And for that reason, within the PhD, if you ever want to look at it when it's finally online, there are reception tests in there too. So there are specific experiments I've set up that are only visual, only auditory, then a combination of both. And there are test subjects.
Cool.
And they write down their responses and how they felt.
Did you ever hand out sheets at the performances?
No.
How did you feel after this performance?
I was tempted. I could have, but it wasn't really a requirement, because I'd pretty much covered that in the reception tests that I'd done.
Right.
So there wasn't really a requirement to do it by that
need
point.
To do it, yeah, because otherwise people would be going, oh, am I an audience member or a guinea pig here?
No, I didn't want to put people in that state. So no, it was more a performative event. Mainly for the performers, but I did get, you know, just anecdotally from talking to people.
Of course.
How did you feel that, you know?
Yeah.
And you might recall, did you go to that?
I got there late.
Got there late.
Yeah.
Do you remember the coloured archway?
Yeah.
And it was all lit up lights and they had little couches and all that.
Yes.
Well, that particular funny aspect of the wonderful Blue Mountains Cultural Centre that we have up here, there's a really odd auditory phenomenon because of the curved arch. And if you do a little clap, you'll hear a slapback echo. It varies depending on where you walk along that archway.
Okay. Were you aware of that before you set up?
Completely.
And so you did use it.
It's based on it.
Yeah, you're right.
The tempo of the event is timed exactly to the echo, the slapback echo off the window.
Mm.
So I was maximising that particular zone or space for the music. So all the timings of every piece of music, and even though they vary, they're all different subdivisions of the beat, dependent on that slapback echo and that timing in that space.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
And what were some of the key findings for you? You know, are there some fun facts that you can share that could be interesting for our listeners?
Going into a bit of theory here. I guess it gets the cross-modal aspect between the auditory and the visual comes down to, and there's various theorists on this. There's a chap called Vittorio Galassi who teaches at the University of Parma in Italy, And he sees that basically any aesthetic experience that we have is bound to be somatic and cross-modal, because it's a whole body experience. When we see art, visual art, we're not just seeing it with our eyes. There's all the other aspects of our senses that we bring into that experience, and it's quite tactile. So when you see the brush strokes on a painting, for example,
yeah,
there is also an imagined gesture, and this, they've done tests on this, that people have a sensory comportment to feel the brush stroke and, you know, actually imagine the painter laying the paint onto it. So it's a whole body experience. So that was very important for me to find out.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And that's reflected in other aspects. I use phenomenology as a sort of backdrop for the whole examination. So it has a basis. And phenomenology is very much a philosophy of stripping things back to the bare basics. And so you look at things that are purely sensorial. How can I put it? It's sort of ripping everything back to basics. Yeah. So I look at this thing in front of me, and yes, I know it's a laptop computer, it's the MacBook Pro, but I sense the tactile nature of it. I feel the coldness of the metal of the laptop and the colours and everything. You're reducing everything back to its bare bones before you attach any semiotic significance or signs or symbols or what it might signify, any of that sort of stuff.
Mm.
We're just accepting things purely for what they are. So that's a great start point, and then you can overlay what you want from there, I guess, and all the different associated theories. There's a ton of stuff in the thesis, but I'll be here for an hour.
Yes. Well, look, we might include some links to your thesis for anyone who's interested in delving into that a little bit further. Mm. We might also include a link to your Vimeo site, which has got some really fantastic like experiments, you know, on suspension as well. So, which is just absolutely beautiful.
Mm.
Again, combining, you know, I noticed one of the experiments was, I think it was, you know, just sound, and then, you know, you've layered or just added different components. So, you know, you layer the visual on top of that, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So I'm sure there's people out there who'll be interested to, look at this a little bit further.
I hope so.
It's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
Great work.
I think it's important because, I mean, I guess if we're looking at an end goal for the thesis, this state that I tend to find, or what I call a state of suspension, it's really conducive to creativity.
Mm.
So when you, I guess, are in the circumstances for this sort of experience to be facilitated, whether it's through visuals or music or sound, it builds little worlds for you, little creative worlds, and it really can put you in that state where you're just imagining so much stuff. I mean,
yeah,
that's why I dig into it, because I just go, wow, this is such a potent experience for creativity. I really want to dig in and find out how it actually works. So that's pretty much the basis of the thesis. That's where I'm coming from.
I'm really interested in knowing what next.
Yeah.
Like, you've finished this now, and there just seems to be a whole world of possibilities for you. You're still kind of just relaxing and enjoying the space, new space you have, or are you already thinking, you know, there's so much more I want to explore, and how can I...
There is. I mean, I don't want to present this as a fait accompli or anything, because I think, look, there are other people researching in very similar areas, probably more defined areas, but, you know, obviously it has implications for aesthetics and how we appreciate artwork, whether it be auditory or visual, or something more tactile like sculpture, or kinetic like dance. There's so many different applications.
Are you doing like a follow-up? Would you be doing, do you think you'll... Because you said it was like off air, you said 6 months probably until it's all finalised, until you...
So it's, the thesis is with the examiners at the moment.
Yeah.
We'll see what they say. I hope they don't say it's a load of rubbish, but I think it's...
I think you're pretty safe, yeah.
I think you're pretty good.
Yeah.
We'll see. I'd like to do the performance again, but it was site-specific, so it was designed to work particularly with the Cultural Centre, but I'd like to see if we can do some variations on it. Obviously, I get to have a bit of fun with papers on doing this stuff, so we take bits out of it.
Segments of it, yeah.
And do
not really something you do with the Winstons, but...
No. Yeah. But we get to explore, and we did that live podcast with Chris Cannell little while ago, which was great. That was nice.
Have you actually recorded as a CD?
Funny you should say that, Brad. Following that performance, we went to the studios down at Western Sydney University and recorded the entire performance over again.
Excellent.
Improvised.
Right.
So, and that should be emphasised, States of Suspension.
As a pretty much a live performance.
Yes, because it is a structured piece of music, but all the performances with it are totally improvised.
Right.
So we make up what we make up on the spot.
Okay, so it's not going to be exactly the same as what was up there. It's going to be...
No, it's different again. Structurally, it's the same. It's
part
the same,
two.
It's the same five sweet pieces all strung together. But no, it's quite different performances again.
Right.
So I'm just in the mixing stage of that. I'm glad you asked. I'm just mixing that at the moment. I'd like to have it out before Christmas, but...
great Christmas present.
It could be a great Christmas present if you want to get into that zone.
Yeah. No, definitely.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, look, we might just cut to a break and we'll come back after a song.